funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What was it like to be educated in a one-room schoolhouse? With millions of Texas kids headed back to school this week, the image of that idyllic American icon is seemingly everywhere. The red clapboard walls, a cupola with a big iron bell, and an interior filled with happy students and lined with chalkboards. As it turns out, a lot of our nostalgia for those bygone days is based on myth. One-room schools were often poorly equipped, questionably staffed, and remarkably uncomfortable. So why do we remember them so differently? And what does that enduring mythology tell us about how we look at the challenges of teaching our children? Jonathan Zimmerman is professor of education and history at New York University. His new book is called Small Wonder, The Little Red Schoolhouse in History and Memory. John, welcome to Think.
Thanks a lot for having me.
We should start with this. We're going to sort of bust up everybody's day. In fact, the Little Red Schoolhouse was very often not red at all.
Yes, I know that will disappoint your listeners, but in most cases it wasn't, and the reason is quite simple. Paint is expensive. Most of the time, one-room schoolhouses were painted white because, for a variety of reasons, that was the cheapest shade, or they were just left unpainted, so they would sort of revert to a kind of a weather-beaten gray. But in rare cases were they red.
And in some cases, these buildings were expected to function as more than just a school.
Oh, absolutely. And that's actually one of the themes of my book, as I try to explain the enduring power of this icon. They were, in rural America, often the only public building within miles. So although, of course, they were the school, they were also the place where elections were held, where marriages and funerals were held, where there were debates, public dramas, other kinds of entertainments. So they were absolutely a community center, and in most places they were the community center.
How did these kinds of schools first come into vogue in this country?
Well, they came into vogue for a simple reason. The United States was an overwhelmingly rural nation. We think that in the early 19th century, the vast majority of Americans lived on the countryside in communities smaller than 5,000. And school was also, and I should add, continues to be, locally controlled. It's not as locally controlled as it was, but especially in terms of the way it's financed, it continues to be locally controlled. And the way they spread it up was people would move to a new place. They would name it after themselves or an ancestor. Sometimes they would kill or evict the human beings that were already living there, and then they would elect a school board. That was, in a very real sense, theirs, insofar as it was locally controlled. It was run by people from the community who were elected to serve as school trustees, now we call it school boards, and who were in charge of really every aspect of the schooling that took place there.
So if you have a largely rural population and small populations to begin with, it stands to reason that there was not a lot of money for these things. We imagine them sort of nicely outfitted with a little potbelly stove and chalkboards, but very often they had almost nothing inside.
Absolutely. You know, these school trustees were often very parsimonious gentlemen. I mean, we're talking about a time, by the way, when only men can vote. And they wanted to get the very most they could from a very, very small educational dollar. So you can see this especially in the siting of these schools. You know, we imagine them in these bucolic fields, lush and verdant, but actually they were in the parts of town that nobody wanted. They were either on the top of hills where it was barren, or they were in swamps, or sometimes they were in the little triangular spaces that were formed by the crossing and confluence of different wagon trails, so that in fact the school districts would have to put up a big boulder right at the corner of the school, lest the wagons run over the kids, which was a common way that people met their maker in the 19th century.
Yeah, and how did kids get there? I guess some of them could walk.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, all of them could. The idea of the school bus, of course, doesn't come until the 20th century, where you have the federal sponsorship of roads, right? You have automotive transportation, and you have eventually the consolidation of these small little school districts into larger ones and larger schools. But that's a 20th century phenomenon. Before then, everyone walked. I should tell you, no American should be proud of this, but in the 20th century, the first people to ride the bus were whites, and the last people were black. So blacks had to continue to walk to their school, sometimes 4 or 5 miles. And there are several very troubling memoirs of white kids on buses who would tease and throw profanities at blacks who had to walk because they couldn't take the bus yet.
Yeah, and the idea of school segregation was not limited to the centralized schools that we imagine when we look back on the newsreels from the 20th century. In fact, from the beginning, schools were almost entirely segregated.
Oh, absolutely. And the poorest ones were, of course, African-American schools. And as I was indicating earlier, African-Americans were really the last people to be in the one-room schoolhouse because they weren't allowed into these new and much fancier consolidated schools. Because of that, one of the points I try to make in my book is that African-Americans don't romanticize the one-room school, which I find fascinating. Almost everybody does. And as we'll talk about later, they find different things to romanticize in it. But you rarely find black people romanticizing it because their one-room schools were the poorest of the poor. Often, you know, so cold, for example, that buckets of water that were in there for the kids to drink would freeze. Not an uncommon event.
Yeah, there was no guarantee that there would be a stove or a window or even an outhouse built next to the school.
That's right. I mean, it depended on the wealth and generosity of the community. And some were wealthier and some were more generous than others. And outhouses are a very good example of that. Sometimes they existed, sometimes they didn't. And on the plains, well, I mean, in the East, where it was at the time quite wooded, you really didn't need outhouses in the sense that you could send kids to the forest. But out in the Great Plains, that wasn't the case. So you had separate recesses for boys and girls. So that they could answer the call. And one of the ways that boys, of course, got in trouble, which they did a lot, was by peeking at the girls during the girls' recess.
Jonathan Zimmerman is my guest. He's professor of education and history at New York University. His new book is called Small Wonder, The Little Red Schoolhouse in History and Memory. I want to talk for a minute about teachers, because reading this book, you get the sense that this was a really varied lot. You didn't quite know who you were going to get when you hired someone to teach in your little school.
Absolutely not. I mean, you didn't know who you were going to get, but in a sense you did, because especially in the first part of the 19th century, the person you got was a young woman from that community, often somebody who had barely more education than the kids themselves. Keep in mind that public high schools as mass institutions don't really kick in until the late 19th century and especially the early part of the 20th century. So it would most likely be a young woman who was a graduate of the same school, always unmarried because in most places it was illegal for a married female to teach. If there wasn't somebody from that community, you would try to find somebody from another one who had board with a family in the community. But they were overwhelmingly female, all unmarried, again, possessing very little formal education.
How, first of all, what sorts of priorities were they given or did they hold in terms of what sort of instruction to provide?
Well, you know, the instruction, as best we can tell, that's actually the hardest question for historians to answer. Because as you might guess, it's a lot easier to find records about the financing of a school or the identities of people who went there than what actually occurred in the classroom, right? For that, you have to rely on memoirs. And as best we're able to piece together, The education was almost entirely rote. By rote, it was based on memorization and recall. So you have a number of children between the ages of 3 and 20. You may have as few as 5 of those kids, but there could be as many as 100. You were supposed to teach them 8 different subjects at however many different grade levels exist. So my math isn't good enough to figure out how many recitations that should be, but it's dozens.
Yeah.
So the basic system was kids read out of whatever book they have or can afford, which is another issue because some kids couldn't. And then different groups of them, based both on age and subject matter, would come up to the so-called school marm and recite. And recite meant exactly that. There were 11- and 12-year-old kids who could say an entire 300-page book.
Wow.
Because that's what teaching and learning was.
But they weren't necessarily asked to consider what the book meant.
Oh, certainly not. And I think that a lot of 19th century Americans would be quite confused by that question. the book meant what it said. And your job, quite literally, was to say the book.
In defense of that system, which now sounds really almost barbaric to us, I guess there's almost no other way to handle it. If you've got kids from ages 3 to age 20, and you've got to get something into their heads in the course of a 6 or 8 hour day.
Absolutely. I mean, there were very good practical reasons for this system. The system worked. You know, it might not meet our own pedagogical standards, but that's not really the interesting historical point. The interesting historical issue, I think, is trying to figure out why it made sense to those people at that time. And I think one reason was precisely because of this enormous burden that was placed on the teacher. I think you're right. It is hard to imagine another system that, given all those constraints, could have worked. Also, if I could say one more thing in defense of this system, when people got out of line, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, the other thing that the teacher did was hit the kids. I won't defend that, but I will point out that one of the infractions was not spelling well. And your penalty for that was sometimes to cut out letters from a newspaper and eat them, and eat the letters, which is where we think, although one can't be sure, we get the phrase eating your words. Why do I find this admirable? Not because, you know, I want the teachers today to force-feed letters to kids, but you think about the pedagogical assumptions beneath this punishment, right? And what they are is, if you didn't do your spelling or your sums, it's because you're lazy. It's not because you're, you know, quote, differently abled, right? It's not because we're differentiating people based on ability. This was the era before IQ tests, right?
Yeah.
So if you don't do your work, it doesn't have to do with your ability. It has to do with your initiative. And there may be something that we can learn from that.
Well, I was really interested to read, you know, things like when we think back fondly on what we think, most people don't actually remember it personally, but they know the stories they've heard.
Right.
You think about things like spelling bees, and it sounds like so much fun, and the community comes together. In fact, these could be used occasionally quite mercilessly to rank and even label students and their intellectual abilities.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the themes of my book is that everybody finds something different in the little red schoolhouse that they want to find. And especially in the 60s and 70s, in the sort of the heyday of so-called progressive education and open schooling, one of the things that people on the left said is that the Little Red Schoolhouse was kind of this communal utopia because it was familial, it had kids of different ages, and most of all, they cooperated with each other. You've heard, no doubt, the bromide cooperative learning. Mm-hmm. In the 60s, we reimagined the Little Red Schoolhouse as this kind of this lodestar of cooperative learning. And, of course, this is preposterous for exactly the reasons you're talking about. The spelling bee is the antithesis of that. The spelling bee is not, hey, we're all in this together. The spelling bee is, you get this word wrong, you go to the back of the line, and I'm going ahead of you.
I'm really interested, and we will have to take a break before we get really into the idea of discipline, but everyone's aware of the fact that students were hit, but I was amazed that communities didn't universally agree with this, that there were people who said, don't you lay a hand on my child.
Absolutely. You know, there's a great tradition in American letters and educational history of discipline for the other guy's kid. When it's your own kid, suddenly things are different. Now, you know, it's very hard to generalize about matters like this because, you know, as you'll see in the book, in 1913, we think that still over half of the kids in America went to a one-room school. Kids who went to school, by the way, that means, you know, 212,000 different schools. So generalizing across them is hard. Sometimes it's clear there were parents who actually praised the teachers for hitting the kids and would, like, bring them in rulers and paddles to do it. Then there were others who would show up at school with their own paddle or with a knife or with a gun and say, hands off my kid.
Let's pause there. Jonathan Zimmerman is with us. His new book is called Small Wonder, The Little Red Schoolhouse in History and Memory. We'll talk more after the break. You can join us at 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jonathan Zimmerman. He's professor of education and history at New York University. His new book is called Small Wonder, The Little Red Schoolhouse in History and Memory. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. It's really interesting, John, that although these schools were obviously limited in what they were able to do and in how much they succeeded, people felt very proud of the fact that their communities had come together and put these schools together. And so it sort of stands to reason that ardent demonstrations of patriotism were part of the one-room schoolhouse pretty much from its inception.
Oh, definitely. And with respect to pride, I mean, I would emphasize that they had a lot to be proud of. By 1850, a greater fraction of kids in this country go to school than in any nation in recorded history. I think that's something for any American to be proud of. Interestingly, we never really had a debate in this country about whether poor people should go to school or whether girls should go to school. We had big debates about what they should do in school and what they should do afterwards. But, I mean, those were heavily contested issues in places like the United Kingdom, not here. And so there's a good reason, I think, to be proud. The pride is primarily local in the early 19th century, pride in our community for coming together and, you know, and schooling everyone, at least at the primary level, not at the secondary level. But another story that I tell is that in the late 19th century and early 20th century, the schoolhouse becomes a national symbol. It takes its place alongside the flag, especially Uncle Sam, and the Statue of Liberty. Why is that? Well, you know, I do think that part of it has to do with the fact that this is the age of empire. The United States did have an overseas empire in places like the Philippines, Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, Hawaii. And all these places, again, the United States as a colonial power educates a greater fraction of its so-called subjects than in any other empire. In fact, I found amazing letters from British colonials in India who come to the Philippines, and the first thing they say is, why are you schooling all these people? And the Little Red Schoolhouse was a symbol of that. It was a symbol of a national faith in education as a lever of progress. Again, we disagree about what progress is, and lots of people could argue that the colonization of the Philippines was not progress. But the symbol, as a symbol of American of progress, I think is the vital point.
And our disagreements about the appropriateness of prayer in schools and using the Bible as a teaching tool, these are clearly not new, although very often we tend to assume that everybody was fine with it up until a certain point.
Yeah, and of course that's never the case. There was certainly more consensus in local districts that were, let's just say, monocultural, where everybody was a white Protestant. But the other point I try to make in my book is, especially in the Midwest, these local school districts are incredibly diverse. We tend to think of ethnic and racial diversity as an urban phenomenon. But please keep in mind that the first mosque in this United States was in Ross, South Dakota. That's because a whole bunch of Syrians moved there. Of course, the major immigrant groups in that part of the country were Scandinavian, right? They were Norwegian, Swedish, Icelandic. And their presence caused tremendous tension within these school districts.
Jonathan Zimmerman is my guest. His book is called Small Wonder. Let's go on the phone to Thomas in Dallas. Hello, Thomas.
Yeah, I wanted to comment about one vestige of the one-room schoolhouse we keep today, and that was school closing, at 3 o'clock. And with two parents working, that seems to be just an absurdity. You know, that we have these warehouses for kids for three quarters of the day, and then we close them down for the last quarter and force people to house these kids in, you know, daycares and that. That's a huge national expenditure as we subsidize that. And it seems you could extend the school hours maybe on a voluntary basis, and kids could check in or check out if they have other things to do. But I just don't know why we still hold to that, because it doesn't seem to fit, you know, our world anymore.
Well, it's a really interesting point that Thomas is raising. I think that he's right that our school calendar, both the daily and the monthly calendar, do date, of course, to 19th century rural America. In the one-room schoolhouse, as you might guess, there was a summer term and the winter term, right? Because the idea was that in the fall and the spring, in the spring you'd be planting, in the fall you'd be harvesting. Of course, that was at a time when almost everybody was a farmer, and now almost nobody is. But I think that there's a different rationale for the present calendar that doesn't have to do with the seasons or the weather or agriculture, but it has to do with sports. When there's a complicated question in contemporary American education, you don't know the answer. If you say sports, about 4 out of 5 times you'll be right. And this is actually a very good indication of that. The high school kids, we know this, we have counted it. They don't learn anything in the first period. Even the really good students, you can test and show this, and that's because they're not awake. But nevertheless, we ask these adolescents to go to school at 7. Why? Because school has to end at 2:30 because they have to have 3 hours for sports. So far as I know, Minnesota is the only state that's thus far taken this on.
Yeah, basically their body clocks are sort of wired differently during that
That's
time
right.
in their lives.
And those of us who are parents, I mean, my kids are teenagers now, but I remember when they were little kids, of course, it was the opposite, right? They got up at 6:30, school didn't start until 9. They're the ones who should be going to school at 6:30. They're up.
They were just happy to be there.
Yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Talk for a minute about how the concept, John, of centralized schools and school districts started to evolve. And then there was a sort of a rabid fight between people who wanted to keep the one-room schoolhouse and people who wanted their kids in these centralized schools.
Well, it began, this battle and this phenomenon, which we call consolidation, it really started during the so-called progressive era, which is, you know, the era in at the White House level of, you know, Roosevelt, Taft, Wilson. But an era of dramatic social reform, social and political reform, all across the United States. We tend to think of it in urban terms, right? Things like, clean water and pure food and drugs and fair elections. But of course, it had a rural dimension too, and the rural dimension was very much focused on cleaning up the school. Why? Because the one-room school was, according to the progressives, a dated relic. A hangover of America's frontier past, which was no longer appropriate for this new modern age. There's a reason we call them progressives, right? They put this accent on progress. And they said, you know, this is a classic case of cultural lag, which was the progressive terms for something that's behind the times. What we need to do is close these schools because, and you could look it up, and they were great counters. The teachers tended to be less qualified. Certainly the school plant was grubbier. The school day and the school year were shorter. And the progressives published all these statistics in an effort to persuade rural folks to consolidate their schools. And the rural folks themselves disagreed. Obviously, some of them signed on. The schools would not have consolidated if they hadn't. But others said, now, wait a second. What we're going to be giving up is precisely our identity, because our identity as citizens is tied up in this locality. And this institution is, in fact, the public heart of the locality. So that was kind of the key hinge of the debate there.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Fort Worth and speak with Chuck. Hello, Chuck.
Hey, in reference to the rote memorization of the one-room schoolhouse, how kids would recite and memorize, I think, as Jonathan said, like 300-page books when they were 9, 10, 11 years old.
Yeah.
It seems that the modern school today has reversed that to say that, you know, you sort of were making reference to the fact that if they've memorized that much information, they can't possibly be thinking deeply about it. And I happen to think the reverse is true, that if you memorize that much information, you can't help but think deeply about it. And in modern schools today, we're not required to memorize anything, but we're required to think very deeply about it, you know, sort of show off our thinking ability. Whereas I don't think if you don't have it memorized, there's no way you can possibly think deeply about it.
I think the point is really well taken. And I think that our discussions of issues like this, I think, are deeply problematic and deeply polarized and don't reflect a lot of the nuance that your comment reflects. Let me just clarify what I was trying to say in my comments about rote. As I understood it, the question was, you know, did the schools place an accent on analysis? And the answer to that is no. It doesn't therefore follow that nobody was analyzing, right? More to the point, I would say you can't analyze without a certain amount of memorization. You can't think about something unless you know what that something is. So, you know, unless you know the proper decade of the Civil War, right, which it appears most Americans still don't, you can't really analyze its causes. So I think the point of the talk is of the gentleman's comment is extremely well taken. There is no natural inconsistency between memorizing and thinking. Indeed, you probably have to do a certain amount of memorizing to think. But I do think there's an issue in terms of what our larger goal is. What do we want the kids to be able to do at the end of the day? Do we want them just to be able to recite, or do we want them to think for themselves? And I think that there's an enduring issue about that.
The other thing that comes up very briefly in the book is the emphasis on handwriting that used to exist. And it's funny that you mentioned the Palmer method, because my grandmother, who had gorgeous handwriting, would always talk about how it was only possible this way. And we can look at this now and sort of chuckle, but if you couldn't write legibly then, you had no way of making yourself understood in print, whereas today kids learn to type often before they learn to print.
Absolutely. I mean, again, you know, we have to look at the context and why a certain practice made sense to the individuals involved. And I think the Palmer method is a great example of that. I wouldn't get very far in the 19th century America as a writer, because nobody would be able to read a darn thing I wrote. If you wanted to get across anything, you had to use a legible script. And, you know, as you're pointing out, that's no longer the case.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have King in Dallas. Hey, King.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Would you ask your guest to comment on the thing called the Rosenwald Schools, and also whether there's any type of database that lists where all these old schools are, if a person wanted to try to acquire one and renovate it?
Oh, boy, this is, where do I start? Two great questions. Very briefly, the Rosenwald schools, this appears in a chapter in my book. Julius Rosenwald, of course, was a great Sears manufacturer and entrepreneur, and also a great philanthropist. And his goal was to clean up the one-room schools of the South that were African-American schools that didn't have the benefit of the state aid that was consolidating the other schools. And the great irony of that story is, because of Rosenwald money, new black schools were often, in some places, especially Tennessee, were often better equipped after the Rosenwalds came in than some white schools, which turned out to be a tremendous embarrassment to white school boards and white state officials, you know, in the era of Jim Crow and white supremacy, and provided an interesting sort of engine for some other improvements in white schools. So that's the Rosenwald story. And I found interesting notes from Rosenwald where he, talking about his schools, he said, so somebody had written something like, can we contribute to this one-room school? And he said, I start at two rooms. I begin at two rooms, you know, and it went up from there. With respect to the database, if you go onto the net, you will find hundreds of different ones. And if you look in my book, you'll see several of them. I think the most popular ones referenced. The caller, interestingly, talked about people acquiring these buildings as homes. And another story I tell in my book is the way that they were adapted, these buildings, after they closed. Remember, in 1913, there are 212,000 one-room schools. That's a lot of buildings. And, of course, most of them have been torn down, but not all of them. And, you know, they include a pediatric office in Indiana called Old Schoolhouse Pediatrics. They include restaurants where the slate is the board on which the specials are written. And as you might guess, there's an inevitable and very American debate between the so-called adapters and the preservationists. The adapters are the people who said, hey, look, this thing was going to fall down anyway, right? If it wasn't for me who made it into my house, it wouldn't even be up. So stop with your historical carping. And the preservers are the ones who say, whoa, this is such a vital part of our historical and educational legacy that we should try to preserve it as close to its original form as possible so people can really see and experience what it was.
The fact that people don't tend to always remember the bad things about these schools, and very often are likely, with the exception, as you mentioned, of African Americans, are likely to sort of romanticize things. You make the point in the book that part of it may come from the fact that during the time when all of these were being remade and rededicated as other things, people who attended these schools were encouraged to come out, share their memories, and those occasions pretty much always invite people to recall only the good things that, that were part of their childhood.
Absolutely. There's a kind of memory industry that surrounds schools. And on the day that they closed, there would often be a ceremony. Then there would be reunions. There would be auctions where different parts of the school were sold. Yes, you know, the word nostalgia means quite literally from the roots. It means a longing for home, for home. And remember, this institution, it's not just a school, it's a house. It's a school house. You know, it's the locus for so many early memories, often familial ones, right? Because a house is a place where a family lives. I do think that there is a tendency, especially when we're talking about an institution of our youth that we associate with youth, to see it through very rose-colored lenses. But again, I think it's important to emphasize that because we differ in our politics, in our ideology, in our culture, in our race and ethnicity, that we remember and forget different things. So even though I think the point's well taken that there are always things we look back fondly on, those things will themselves differ.
We have an email here from Paul in Terrell who says, my mother, born in 1903 in Iowa, taught in a one-room school after just 1 year of college. She said this was not at all unusual. She was glad to have done it and glad she didn't have to go on doing it.
Yeah, well, it was hard. You know, 8 of our presidents taught in one-room schools. Andy Jackson, who was, he wasn't the first one, actually John Adams was, but Andy Jackson said that the reason he went to Reed for law was because being a teacher was too hard.
Jonathan, I think a lot of people would still agree with that. Jonathan Zimmerman is my guest. He's professor of education and history at NYU. His book is called Small Wonder, The Little Red Schoolhouse in History and Memory. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jonathan Zimmerman, who is professor of education and history at New York University. His new book is called Small Wonder, The Little Red Schoolhouse in History and Memory. Let's go to John in Fort Worth next. Hello, John.
Hi, Chris, and hi, Professor.
Hello.
Just like somebody else said, there was a time in Texas when you could get a teaching certificate after 1 year of college. And President Lyndon Johnson was born in 1908, and in 1926 he went to college, which is now called Texas State University San Marcos, and he taught. A lot of people don't remember it, but he taught, and in 1927 he taught mostly Mexican children at the Wellhausen School in Cotilla, 90 miles south of San Antonio.
Yeah, way down there.
You're right, and he taught in high school, and I'm wondering if he taught at, you know, small schools, sort of like you're describing.
Yeah, the Cotilla School, if I recall from Robert Caro's book, was a couple of rooms, not big, and yet he attended a one-room school in Junction City, and there are a couple things that are remarkable about it. First of all, one of his earliest memories is being taught in German, which is fascinating because, again, it goes back to the earlier point about the diversity within these different school districts. Taught in German, not German as a class, but he was taught in German, at least for part of the day, because there was an enormous German community there that I think dated back to, you know, the 1848 era. The second thing that's remarkable is, you know, Johnson was quite a showman. And so when he signed the Elementary School, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which is what we now call No Child Left Behind, in 1965, he, of course, flew to Junction City to his old one-room schoolhouse. It had long been converted into a private home, but they took care of that. And being Lyndon Johnson, he flew out Miss Katie, as he called her, who was his one-room schoolhouse teacher, and told the audience about how he had sat in her lap to recite his lessons.
So he had fond memories.
Yeah, but I love the irony of that because, of course, you know, he is at that time quite literally presiding over the greatest centralization of schooling that had occurred. You know, the incursion of the federal government into a matter that had been overwhelmingly local and state, and yet the locale he chooses and the icon he chooses for celebrating this is, of course, the one-room school, which was also, until a few months ago, the icon that decorated the entrances to the federal headquarters of the Department of Education.
Can you talk for a minute, John, about why liberals and conservatives each have something precious that they take from the notion of the one-room schoolhouse, but in each case it's quite different?
Yeah, well, you know, as I was saying earlier, we're all nostalgic, but we're nostalgic for different things. And one of the reasons that this icon, the Little Red Schoolhouse, has such power over us is that it's broad, it's capacious enough to allow us to read into it what we like. So especially starting in the 1960s and 70s to the so-called New Right, sometimes the New Christian Right, depending on your favorite term, they embrace the one-room schoolhouse as this symbol of authority, of strict discipline, often of religious faith, because it's precisely those values that they see being challenged and threatened by the events of that day. To people on the left, of course, the one-room schoolhouse is precisely the opposite. It's a place of communalism. It's a place of cooperative and group learning. It's a place of age mixing. It's a place of progressive education. It's activity-based. It's connected to the community. And look, nobody likes a scold. I don't like, as a historian, to get on the radio and tell everyone that they're wrong and that their history isn't correct. But all of us distort when we remember, and I think that both of these perspectives are distorted.
Yeah, can you talk about the dangers of remembering the one-room school as a different place than it really was, given that we are unlikely to ever go back to this sort of education?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question. It's one I try to tackle in the conclusion of my book. You know, I think a reasonable objection to what I'm saying might be, okay, so what? We distort it. We misremember it. Why fight that? Why resist that? You know, it gives us a kind of pleasant and nostalgic feeling. Right? It makes us happier. It gives us a sense of connectedness to our past. Why challenge that? Why fight that? First of all, let me emphasize that I'm not solely a critic of the one-room school, as I hope I've been explaining. There are many parts of it that I find admirable. But I also think there's something to the old Santa Ana quote, now cliche, that those who forget history are destined to repeat it. If we idealize the schooling that we had, it's going to be quite difficult for us to improve the schooling that we will have. I think for too many people who look at the one-room schoolhouse, they say, you know, those were the days, man. Everything was peachy keen. You know, we walked to the school in the snow, you know, uphill both ways. nobody gave the teacher any guff. You learned your lessons, and you went home. This strikes me as profoundly unhelpful because it makes us think that we fell from a kind of Garden of Eden and that the only way we'll improve is to somehow get back into the garden, if that's possible. But, of course, on reflection, this doesn't really make sense. There were many things to laud, to praise about the one-room school, but there are also many things to criticize, and if we lose sight of those things, especially the way learning happened, it's going to be very hard for us to make it better.
Let's go next on the phones to Don in Fort Worth. Hey, Don.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, this is Don. There's something that nobody's touched on. I was privileged as a teenager to actually sit in on a one-room schoolhouse being conducted. It was back in the late 40s. And the class was arranged with six columns of these seats with the, you know, with the back had the desks on them. And they were arranged as the teachers saw them from left to right, first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth grade. So what occurred to me was that the kids in first grade, if they wanted to, or if they were a little bit smarter than the rest of them, they could listen in very easily on what was happening in the second, the third, the fourth, fifth, sixth grade. And by the time they were up there, they had heard it all. And so it seems to me like there was a lot of educational spillover and a great benefit educationally to the younger kids as they went through the system.
Well, you know, it's a really interesting point, and I think well taken. There's no question that there are advantages to multi-age classrooms. And in the 60s and 70s, when multi-age classrooms came back into vogue, I think they've since left the vogue, a lot of people made arguments precisely like Don is making, and I think there was some validity to them. But I also think it's fair to say that insofar as this kind of cross-age schooling happened, it almost happened in spite of the system, not because of it. That is, the idea that these institutions were cooperative institutions where the kids taught each other is flawed because the kids weren't supposed to do that. They may have done it anyway. But the ideal was for the kid to be quiet and do her or his own lesson. The most common form of infraction, actually, was talking to your neighbor. So the caller may be right that the kids taught each other in an important way, but I also think it's important to emphasize that often they taught each other in spite of what they were supposed to do, not because of it.
And kids who weren't able to keep up at the most basic level often were just told not to come back.
Oh, definitely. One of, to me, the both funniest and saddest distortions is when mainstreaming becomes a kind of educational movement, and some might say bromide. That is the mainstreaming of differently abled kids. A lot of people, of course, invoke the one-room schoolhouse. You know, those were the days because anybody could go, and we were all put together no matter what our ability level. Well, no. I mean, I wish that were the case, you know. You know, as somebody who is, you know, deeply concerned about the education of disabled people in this country, I would love to be able to get on the radio and say, oh, yeah, back in the good old days, right, it didn't matter how disabled you were. We were all in this together, and we could all go to the one-room school. No, you know, sorry. It's quite rare that somebody who has a profound mental disability in the way that we would understand the term would go to a one-room school for more than a year. They were excluded. That's the history.
Let's go next on the phones to Katie in Dallas. Hello, Katie.
Hi. My question was about the differences and the perceived differences between left and right-handed children. We found out much later in life that my grandfather was rapped on the knuckles so many times for writing left-handed that he was actually crippled.
No.
So whether or not that was like part of the curriculum that everyone had to be right-handed, or whether or not it was maybe something that each individual teacher had in mind.
Well, if the curriculum means in the broadest sense what the kids are taught, it was absolutely part of the curriculum. And it's also fascinating in how many cultures this has been the case. It's not just an American thing. If you travel around the world, you see that left-handedness is stigmatized. Continues to be stigmatized, often quite dramatically and violently in many parts of the world. And, of course, in the ways that the caller is eloquently illustrating, it was stigmatized here as well. Of course, I'm sure you know that the current president of the United States is left-handed. So is Bill Clinton. And I think the other ones were Bush Sr., that is, George Bush the First, and Harry Truman. But if you think about how many presidents we've had, right, I think it's important that they've all been of very recent vintage. Because I'm sure during Truman's youth, and Bush Sr.'s youth, it was stigmatized as well, but not to the same degree that it was prior to that time.
We have time briefly for one more call. We'll go to Kathleen in Dallas. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello. I'd like to read this book. Can I buy it at any bookstore?
Absolutely, and you can get it on the net. It's at Amazon. It's from Yale University Press.
Okay.
You can just search my name, Jonathan Zimmerman. Or, of course, you can just wait for the movie. but they're never the same book and movie, right? You've been down that road. You know, you really like the book. You go to the movie, you're disappointed. So you might want to read the book first.
It's Brad Pitt.
I want to read the book. This is my question. In his book, in his autobiography, President Jimmy Carter talked about the little school he went to, and he said that he wrote some length about the ones for African Americans, which were not even a schoolhouse. He said they would meet in a church, they'd meet in somebody's home, and they didn't even meet 5 days a week. And this was already the 1930s. I wonder if that
absolutely.
That
you know, I'm really glad that you brought up that point because it's extremely well taken. Sometimes the black schools and school districts are so poor that they literally can't afford even a shack of a one-room school, and they would meet in church basements. That was quite common. Sometimes, as the caller's indicating, in private homes. And one of the ways we found out about this, of course, is that in the 1930s, during the New Deal, the Farm Security Administration sends now very famous photographers with names like Dorothea Lange and Walker Evans and Russell Lee all over the countryside, especially the American South. And one of the things that they did was take pictures of precisely the institutions and the configurations the caller is describing. There was a series of very famous pictures showing African Americans meeting in church, and the caption said something like, "Unable to afford a school, the Negro children meet in the church." And I think it's important to note that it's largely because of the New Deal and its kind of photographic dimension that we know about that.
Having looked at this, John, from all sides, what would you say we could take from the tradition of one-room schools that if applied today, might improve the education system? Is there anything?
Well, I'd say a few things. You know, I would say, first of all, I would say the sense of communal responsibility, despite how dilapidated they were and despite how, in some cases, as I'm describing, exclusionary they were, these institutions were shared, and the people, at least the voters in the community, felt a communal responsibility for them, felt that they were in a really an important sense of theirs. And because the institution was theirs, these different citizens came together in a variety of ways to debate and deliberate what they wanted to teach their kids. Look, you know, schools are central public institutions for doing that. Obviously, there are many private institutions that socialize kids, and the most important is the family, and now, of course, media institutions, you know, but almost all of them are private.
So sorry, we're out of time now. Jonathan Zimmerman's new book is called Small Wonder, The Little Red Schoolhouse in History and Memory. It's been a real pleasure, John. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was fun.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.